Good evening, Current Affairs listeners. My name is Nathan Robertson. I am the editor of Current Affairs magazine, and I am here tonight with my co-editor, newsletter editor, Nick Slater. Hello, Nick.
Hi, hi.
I am here with senior editor, Brianna Rennox.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a very special guest on the program this evening, Megan Day. She is a staff writer at Jacobin magazine. She has also published in the New York Times, The Guardian, Vox, Verso, Mother Jones, and many other places. And she is the author of the book Maximum Sunlight. But we are here to talk to Megan Day tonight about an article she's just written for Jacobin called One Year Off Every 7 Years, which is an article in praise of the sabbatical. And I just want to read the opening paragraph for our listeners before I ask Megan about the thrust of the article. She starts, "Our world is a marvel. There's a place in the Alhambra called the Court of the Myrtles, where at night the moon reflects off a pond teeming with goldfish and lights up the impossibly ornate fretwork on the arches above. With knowledge, materials, and time, a person can create their own new orchid hybrid, never before seen on Earth, or fashion a wooden automaton, topped with a hand-carved figurine that twirls or dances on command. Most people don't spend very much of their time engaging with the world's wonders. Instead, most people work, and when they're done working, they attend to unnecessarily arduous life maintenance tasks, and if they happen to have time left over, they're often too exhausted to do much besides watch television or sleep. This is a travesty." So, Megan, why are you writing about the wonders of the world?
Yeah, it's a good question. I figure if you open the piece, you're not entirely sure why. I'm just praising our world for being so marvelous. But what I'm actually getting at is the idea that people should have time to explore this world, and that people currently don't have time to do that. Whether it's in small ways like, you know, learning a craft, or as I've mentioned in the piece, some other things you could do with your time, like looking into the archives to flesh out your family tree. Or of course, there's just the stuff like spending time with your kids as they're growing up. A lot of people don't have time to do this because they're working so hard. And the reason that people are working so hard is because we live under capitalism. So we don't actually reverse engineer the amount and type of work that people have to do based on what we want society to look like, and if we've sort of democratically decided we want society to look like. Instead, we fork over that decision to private companies, which are motivated by the pursuit of profit, and they come up with work for us to do that would help them attain greater profits. A lot of it is kind of pointless. A lot of it is very alienated, but you have to do it anyway, because if you don't own the means of production, if you are not a capitalist yourself, then you have to work for a wage in order to have access to the basic means of survival. So that's all a prelude to getting us into an idea that's not an original idea to me, but is an idea that I hit on, or somebody actually brought to my attention and really captured my imagination, which is the idea that we could make a demand out of a sabbatical. That workers could demand that we have 1 year off, all to ourselves, to do whatever we want, paid, after every 6 years of work. And that you could use that time to just engage with the world, to do whatever you want, to learn, to travel, to spend time at home. I have a whole thing about how maybe you want to play video games. That's fine. That's an enjoyable part of human existence. And that's really the point of the piece.
I like what you do here, because so often we socialists are accused of not providing a real, meaningful, clear vision of what it might look like to live in a better world. And yet you get very specific in the sorts of things, the real sort of small micro-level experiences that people are missing out on.
Yeah, you're completely right that we don't tend to talk nearly enough about what we think socialism will look like. And in this case, the sabbatical idea actually isn't what it will look like under socialism. It's what it will look like under capitalism with an advanced social democratic political current in power, capable of giving us the things that we might actually enjoy as humans, and sort of partially prefiguring a world under socialism. And the reason I thought it would be a good idea to bring out is because it could be an intermediate demand that would really capture people's imagination and inspire them to fight. And of course, when they're fighting for something that's animated by socialist principles. The idea that time should belong to us, the time of our lives belongs to us and not to the people who would wring us dry for profit.
This was one of those articles, the minute that I started reading it, I just thought, yes. Yes, yes, yes. And the further I got, the more I was thinking, oh my God, yes. This is too fucking brilliant. This is too right. And the one thing that I kept thinking throughout the piece was, why every 7 years? It was a weird thing to fix it on, but why every 7 years?
Well, for one thing, I actually cribbed this from a platform that was put out by a party that started in the United States in the 1990s called the Labor Party, and this was actually their demand. So I'm just taking it. The reason I thought it would be a useful way to present this idea was to present it in the context of what the demand was from the Labor Party. The Labor Party, by the way, was a perfectly admirable attempt, but the political circumstances were really unfavorable to it in the 1990s, of course, and it didn't gain much traction. But they had this wonderful platform. And in a section of the platform, they had a whole section titled More Time for Family and Community. And this was one of their demands, was 1 year off after every 6 years of work. And of course, the year off would be paid. And the reason I think that they chose to do that is because of the word sabbatical. It's the idea that you work for six and you get one off, right? People understand that it's hooky. It has a sort of cultural reference. In fighting for this demand, of course, employers are just going to say, absolutely not. Why would we pay for people and then we don't get anything back from them in the form of labor? So they might say, well, why don't we do, 15 years? Why don't we do 10? And maybe we end up compromising on 10 or something at the beginning. So it's somewhat arbitrary, but I think six and one kind of is reminiscent of the one day off of the week that you're sort of mandated in the Judeo Christian tradition to
oh, we love
rest.
The Judeo-Christian
tradition. Yeah, don't we?
Although, unlike the Judeo-Christian tradition, you can do what you want with your day off instead of having to go sit in church, which always seemed like kind of a bummer to me.
It depends on what kind of church you're
sitting
in.
Yeah, I guess it depends what kind of church it is. In America, it's a huge bummer because our churches suck.
Most of them do suck. Okay, speaking of church, the one thing that really jumped out at me, I think it was right around that part of the story, was that you're saying, yes, this sounds crazy, so did the weekend. That's something I think that we take so for granted right now. Not everybody, because a lot of people do not get 2 days completely free to themselves, in the course of a 7 day week. But the fact that we think that's an injustice, that kind of speaks to how normal it's become that you'd normally have 2 days off per week. I mean, that's a really fucking encouraging sign, isn't it?
It is. And I think that it's important to remember or to just acknowledge that the internal logic of capitalism is such that employers would rather us be working literally every single hour that we are awake and capable of working and not, for example, feeding ourselves, or maybe while you're feeding yourself if you have a desk job, right? Because the more you work, the more that you're producing value, and then profits are when they accumulate the surplus value of your labor, right? So they want you to work all the time. The fact that we have an 8-hour day, though of course people don't typically abide by that in the United States, and the fact that we have a weekend at all, that actually comes from very powerful movements of working people demanding that their time be returned to them from employers who would rather them be working literally every second of their lives. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to connect this. This isn't just a sort of how great would this idea be kind of piece. I'm also trying to make the point that it could mobilize people in the same way that the demand for the 40-hour week or the 8-hour day mobilized people. People fought and died for more free time because that's what people want. People want to live meaningful lives. And of course, the two main ways that workers tend to fight for that are better pay, which allows them to be able to take care of themselves and their loved ones and have some disposable income to pay for things that they might enjoy, and then more free time to actually enjoy it with.
It's kind of funny because on one hand, we give such lip service to this idea of work-life balance. Modern progressive companies are supposed to encourage this, they give you flexi time or whatever. And on the other hand, I forget who published this study, but it just came out last week that it turns out that taking time to actually, be with your family and have work-life balance really knocks your future earnings and limits your career path. So on one hand, it's just another thing to feel guilty for.
I've worked in environments where we have unlimited paid time off, but in the sort of American system where our jobs are not guaranteed, because I was not a unionized worker at that point and I had no job security, I saw firsthand that people actually didn't take nearly as much of that paid time as you'd think they would, because people are pretty scared about performing up to a certain level so as to protect their job prospects. We have this problem all over wherever capitalism is present, but particularly in the United States, because we have an insane devotion to productivity and to work in the United States, that people are often a little bit shy about taking time off because they think that it's going to hurt their reputation as a worker and possibly endanger their job. So part of the sabbatical idea is to actually mandate that time off, to say that it's guaranteed and that your job is going to be there waiting for you. that it's legally required that your job is there waiting for you at the end of your time off. It's also legally required that your employer not contact you for any reason during your sabbatical. I didn't actually put that in the piece, but I think it's really important. You should not hear from your employer not once during your sabbatical.
That means like no Slack messages from Nathan of like cute animal pictures or interesting hats.
Well, who would take a sabbatical from Current Affairs? That's not a thing. No one. I mean, Nathan should definitely take a sabbatical from Current Affairs.
Or at least just go outside like from time to time, Nathan. Nathan, what would you do with a sabbatical year?
I have absolutely no idea what the world is like outside of that. This is why I enjoyed Megan's article, because she's like, you know, there's a whole world outside the Current Affairs offices that people can go see, and it's magnificent, and it has so much splendor. And so now I'm very curious about what that is.
I think that a lot of the impetus for the article comes from, well, there's a certain sensibility that I think socialists sometimes have forgotten. I mean, socialism has been so marginalized by the sort of assault waged on it and on the union movement and workers in general, waged by neoliberalism, that socialism has had to become either extraordinarily sectarian and kind of weird and unrelatable, or extremely pragmatic, trying to find footholds in a very unfavorable political climate. And so we've, in some ways, lost the kind of animating spirit of early 20th century socialism, which, if you recall, one of the popular slogans in the United States and then eventually around the world was bread and roses. That comes from a poem that was written in the first decade, I think, of the 20th century. The line that it comes from is, the worker must have bread, but she must have roses too, which is to say that working people's fight is not simply about, you know, the material means to be able to take care of yourself, though of course it very much is about that. It's also about the right to be able to experience your time on this earth as a human to the fullest.
We forget the roses so often, and I think the roses are tremendously important. You know, I was quite serious when I say, well, semi-serious when I say, you know, oh, I'm just discovering that there's a world out there, because I think one of the things you point out is that people aren't even given a sense of what they're missing. And when you give people a sense of the sorts of things that are really being hoarded by the rich, it's not just wealth, it's not just numbers on a spreadsheet, but it's freedom. Being wealthy confers the freedom to explore and to see and to do as many things. And so the redistribution of wealth is also the redistribution of freedom. And it's something that I think it's so important to find ways to convey just how much is being, you know, inequality is a very dry term, you know, wealth inequality, but freedom inequality and inequality of experience seems to me very powerful.
I encourage everyone, if you haven't yet, to also go read something else that I published on Jacobin recently, which was an interview that I did with the writer Martin Haglund, who wrote a book called This Life. And in it, in the book, he actually has a key concept, which he is called spiritual freedom, which he defines as the ability to ask and to answer the question of what you should do with your time. That's how he defines spiritual freedom. And he says that ultimately capitalism is at odds with the aim of maximizing spiritual freedom for humans, because you have very little time to ask the question about what to do with, right? Like, you have to spend the bulk of your time working for a wage. And then when you're done doing that, like I say in the article, you're sort of left to attend to various tasks that are necessary for your maintenance, many of which ought to be and can be provided by the state, but aren't, or many of which involve enormous hassles to do with the kind of red tape put up by corporate bureaucracies, whether that's you have to, you know, call around to see what doctors are in network, or like get on the phone and haggle with your private insurance company about one surprise medical bill or another. Or maybe you're calling around to refinance your student loans or whatever. These are the kinds of things that people actually end up spending a lot of their remaining quote-unquote free time after work on. Well, that's not free time either. So the point of the sabbatical demand is to actually say that there should be sanctioned in our culture some space for free time. And really, as Martin Haglund would say, that is about time to exercise your spiritual freedom. To ask yourself, what should I do with this time? And to be able to freely answer that question for yourself.
I really love the idea of the sabbatical, partly because, I mean, on the one hand, there's the sort of the wage slavery of capitalism and like the fact that many people are too terrified to take time off, even if it's offered to them, because they don't want to be perceived as unproductive and because their bosses want to find ways to coerce them to stay longer. I also think for people who are in sort of caring or public service jobs, there's this incredible guilt that comes with taking any time off or even within your day, because all you can think about are like, who are the people I'm not helping right now? And I think that that culture is something that becomes very entrenched in workplaces, even ones that have like really good worker principles otherwise. And so the idea that we would kind of like give ourselves a break and just be like, okay, like if you're going to work this hard, you at least need to take a year off every 7 years. That would be something to, you know, give you courage to keep doing the work. If you were like, okay, if I do this for 6 years, I could take a year off and then I could do it again. And like, I feel like that would, you know, energize a lot of people.
I would think it would make you feel a bit less alienated from your labor too, because if your mind is always somewhere else, if you're always sort of feeling overworked and dreaming about different tasks that might be more restorative or whatever, I think that it can make even very connected work feel somewhat alienated. I do think that the idea of a sabbatical might relieve that a little bit, because you could spend your time instead daydreaming about what you're going to do with this guaranteed amount of time off. And I also wanted to say that I would hope that if we were to achieve something like this kind of sabbatical, that most people would use it for truly indulging the wonders of the world, whether that's, you know, traveling or like I say in the article, like taking ceramics classes, or another thing that I said, I think I said something like writing graphic novel adaptations of 11th century Icelandic sagas that nobody asked for, you know, doing that kind of stuff.
Why would no one ask for that? That's amazing.
It's not like it's the 12th century Icelandic saga. I mean, come on.
Yeah, come on.
But I also think that one of the most rewarding ways to engage with the world is actually to participate in activism or movement building, or, you know, building knowledge to that effect. Let's say that you're a person who works in some sort of service profession, that you're doing something, you know, productive to make the world a better place when you're working, and then in your time off, you're relaxing. Maybe that's what you want to do, and maybe you ought to do that, but you'd also have the choice to be able to, like, really get your hands dirty with something that you don't have the time to do that actually is a part of that broader political project of making the world a better place. So I hinted at the piece that maybe there's a, I had some hypotheticals. I said, maybe there's a person who, you know, never got to go to college, so they never got to study abroad. Not that many people who go to college get to study abroad at all. And they've never had an opportunity to travel, certainly not for an extended period of time. Maybe they choose to use their sabbatical to go to Japan. Maybe they go to Hiroshima, where they go to learn Japanese. And the whole purpose for them is to just learn Japanese so they can watch anime without subtitles, because that's what they want to do in the world. But maybe when they're there, they also learn a little bit about the history of the atom bomb. Maybe they, you know, they develop a greater awareness of, you know, the dangers of nuclear proliferation. Maybe when they come home, they have like a greater political consciousness. And maybe, as I said in the piece, they become like a nuclear disarmament activist or something like that. Well, presumably, one of the ideas is that having more time to think and to experience the world could actually produce a broader political consciousness. But for people who already have a political consciousness, you could use that time also to be engaging in activities that you don't get paid for, but that are absolutely necessary for building the kind of movements that we need to change the world. The kind of movements that, of course, will have won such a sabbatical and that are needed to fight for, you know, socialism in the future or whatever else people feel is necessary, like smaller demands that appeal to them and that really speak to them on a human level.
But could I do ceramics by wanted to?
Yes, you can absolutely do ceramics if
thank you,
no one's
like, we have a very firm pro pottery stance on this podcast. Anything that brings more ceramics into the world is a good thing, in my opinion at least. So all of the people on this podcast are relatively young, some of us younger than others, but we're all, I think, in that like prime advertising demographic of like, you know, 18 to 34. And so for us, we have, you know, our whole lives ahead of us, hopefully. We can see this sabbatical plan paying off for us, and it's therefore a pretty easy sell. If I were, say, like a 60-year-old or 70-year-old person who had already put in, you know, my decades and decades of shitty toil, drudgery, you know, probably not even getting a gold pocket watch out of this, you know, at the end. What do you say to them to get them on board with this idea, other than just like, suck it up and go with it, it's past your time?
You know, this kind of thing is not going to be won tomorrow. It's going to be part one as part of a sort of suite of demands being put forward by a movement that will have a lot to offer to those people as well. And so it would be a project of getting them on board with a sort of like broader ideological and political project that contains demands for them too, such as long-term elder care that doesn't cost you a dime. That's a demand that would be, you know, on the same platform as a demand like this. And in fact, if you look at the Labour Party platform, like those demands, those kinds of demands are side by side. So that's kind of the main thing I would say. But I also think that there is always this tension. You see this with, like, when, you know, Elizabeth Warren says that she wants to cancel student debt. People who've paid off a lot of their student debt already feel like this is deeply unfair. And it is really tricky. I mean, it is actually really tricky to have this conversation where it's like, that's really unfair that that happened to you. And we don't want a world like that anymore. And we're going to need you to join the coalition to fight for a different kind of world. Because people feel, I think, rightly embittered that the time of their lives was taken from them, or that earnings that they'd worked so hard to save up were taken from them to give to a student loan provider or something like that. And it's not always an easy thing to answer, but, you know, certainly there were people who had worked 12 hours a day for decades who were a part of the fight for the demand for an 8-hour workday. And that's because it was situated in as a demand of a broader movement that had many other offerings for those people as well.
60-year-old me is sold. Let's get to the fun part. When I was reading your story about the Court of the Myrtles, I was thinking, like, wow, is that based on personal experience? Like, was that like your awakening moment?
I mean, I did go to the Court of the Myrtles and I thought it was beautiful. And I guess I was thinking actually about a vacation that I took. I took a vacation a couple of years ago to southern Spain and northern Morocco. And it was phenomenal. I mean, I watched tons of movies that are set in different locales and different, you know, centuries to feel transported. But there's nothing like actually being at a place like the Court of the Myrtles. You've got to go. But I also kind of chose it a little bit. I mean, I've been to, you know, a lot of different beautiful places, lucky me. One of the reasons that I chose it was because later on in the piece, I say something about how somebody is like, let's say that a person decides to begin their sabbatical by playing Assassin's Creed. Well, eventually, maybe somebody wants to do that their entire sabbatical. That is completely their right. They're going to play video games. That's going to be a nice break for them. Playing games is a pleasurable part of the human experience, and more power to them. But maybe most of the video game sessions that happen under capitalism are like people trying to steal time between work to relax. Maybe a lot of people who start out the year playing video games kind of grow tired of it because it grows a different quality, right? And then they start thinking, well, what else am I going to do with this year? Maybe their favorite part of playing Assassin's Creed was the part where they got to, you know, do hand-to-hand combat on the roofs of the Alhambra. So maybe when they're thinking, what am I going to do with my time, they book a plane ticket to Spain. And then maybe they find themselves in this magical locale. So that's part of why I decided to float the Court of the Myrtles to the top of the article, was to make sure that it had that resonance with the rest of the piece.
I thought it was a lovely anecdote. Have you ever had like a moment while you were traveling that made you think, I wish I could just drop everything for the next year and like dedicate myself to falling down this particular rabbit hole?
Absolutely. So I worked in San Francisco and my parents live in New Mexico. So I would drive all the time between those two places and I would try to pick the most obscure back roads that I possibly could. And on one of these occasions, I drove through this town. It's called Tonopah in Nevada. And I was like, this place is absolutely fucking bizarre. I can't believe people live here. There was a clown themed motel for truckers. And there was like, I looked into it and it turns out that there's like a bunch of UFO sightings. And it's like, it's this tiny little, it's kind of densely packed town in this very, very wide, unpopulated expanse of Bureau of Land Management land where you're not allowed to build anything. So it's this little island of civilization in this like vast, expansive sea. And I remember thinking, I have to come back here at some point and I have to figure out what's going on here for no other reason besides the world is so much stranger than you could ever possibly imagine. And I'm going to be haunted for the rest of my life by the question of what actually goes on in this town until I get the opportunity to answer that. Well, I was incredibly lucky because when I was working a few years later, again in San Francisco, and I was laid off, I actually had enough money saved to do a project for a few months. And this is a rarity because most people actually are not capable of saving that amount of money to be able to do something like that, to take a few months off. And that's exactly what I did. I decided I'm going to go back to Tonopah and I'm going to figure out what the hell's going on there. And I spent 4 months driving to and from the Bay Area and Tonopah and talking to people that I met in the town. And I wrote the book that I wrote Maximum Sunlight is actually an account of me trying to figure out what was going on in this town and talking to residents about their very strange and charming place that they live. I think that people should have that opportunity, right? The opportunity to be able to answer some sort of question that has no real practical purpose, but that just is something they've always wanted to know the answer to. For example, you love drinking tea, and you've always wanted to know what it's like to grow and to make tea in the places where they do that. And so you get the opportunity to answer that question. Or maybe you don't have to travel to do it.
Exploitative is what
I was about to say. You're going to learn some bad stuff.
Yeah, sorry. Bummer.
It's going to be upsetting.
Well, that's where the whole explosion of political consciousness comes in, right? But another thing is maybe you don't have to leave home to do it. Maybe you've just always had, I write in the piece about another hypothetical, a curiosity about like early childhood education for whatever reason. That's just something you've always been kind of curious about, like how does an infant become like a person with a personality? And let's say during your sabbatical, you just pick up a few books and now you suddenly have time to read them. And let's say you're reading those books and you realize this is absolutely fascinating and I want to be thinking about this and learning more about this for a long time to come. And maybe you decide that actually you'd like to change careers from being a typist, which has nothing to do with early childhood education, to being a preschool teacher. And then that's something that a sabbatical would give you the space to explore questions that could actually either just be fun for you or enlightening for you or could potentially meaningfully change your life as well.
Brianna, what would you do with your sabbatical?
Oh, wow. There are too many things I would want to do with my sabbatical. It would be so hard to choose.
What if you had to choose one in the continental U.S.? We can go international later.
Honestly, for me, the place would be less important. I always, and actually increasingly the older I get, I find all places interesting. I think I could like have an enjoyable sabbatical almost anywhere. And I could then just, if I wanted to go somewhere else, I would just, you know, get my car and go. But there are just lots of things that I wish I had time to learn more about and do. I love writing in a way.
No, you don't.
I hate writing. I like to write fiction, but there's no like brain space to do that when you have a job and also like don't have like, you know, like the writers of old, you don't have like a wife doing everything for you. I like to draw. I'm not that good at it, but I really enjoy it. It would be great to like spend a year just trying to get as good at drawing as I can get. In the town where I live, I've been noticing there are like tons of cool birds. Like I'd love to learn more about birds and like watch them. I know Sparky will be horrified by this, but it's so hard to choose because there's like any variety of things that I would just love to have time to do and to really like throw myself into, because like even when I take kind of a substantial chunk of time off, like a week or something like that, I'm never in the headspace where I can get away from thinking about work I should be doing. I think it would probably take something like the length of a year to get into a headspace where I wasn't thinking about work anymore.
And where you're not just recovering from work. I mean, that's part of the idea animating the sabbatical, is that presumably a lot of people would begin their sabbatical year just recovering from the 6 years of work that they'd done. But then eventually you move through that and you start to maybe grow a little bit restless. And then the sort of questions, the questions of like spiritual freedom start to come up. What, asking and answering, what should I do with my time?
That's why I love this medical idea instead of just enough vacation time, right? I tried to take a vacation for the first time in years recently and it didn't really work because I went to England and I tried to enjoy myself and I did somewhat, but current affairs are still infecting my brain. And I have had the same thing as Brianna, where I'd love to try and learn to draw or paint or something. But I know that time I spend doing that is time that I'm not working on the magazine. And I can't do it. It's not possible for me to give my attention to something when you have this divided consciousness. And I like the way you sort of want people to spend some time decoupling their identity from their work and sort of not forcing them, but allowing them to this long process. One thing gets to lead to another and lead to another and lead to another. And as you mentioned, you don't know where it's going to go. Whereas if you just have these vacations scattered throughout, it really just isn't the same.
Well, I think that's also why you need both. You couldn't have a sabbatical year like in place of a non-sadistic vacation schedule like there is in the US. That's another thing that like I think is worth keeping in mind here. The United States is a profoundly fucked up outlier when it comes to its like time off policies. For me lately in my day job, I've been working a lot with this team from Ireland. And so like Ireland is pretty much as close to the US in terms of like, you know, culture and food and yada yada as you're gonna get. Maybe not exactly. I'm looking at you, Brianna, sorry. But their approach to time off, it's like night and day. Because like here, you know, the U.S. part of the team is thinking like, all right, guys, you know, got to put in our 60 hours a week. If I'm slacking you on a Saturday morning, like you better be answering. And they're just kind of like, nah, fuck off. Like, it's a bank holiday. But you had a bank holiday 2 weeks ago. Yeah, you have a couple of them every month. Like, we're not monsters. We're not going to work, you know, every day of the month. And for us Americans, we're like, but that's slacking. Like, someone's going to get ahead of you. And it's like, no, like, you're not losing anything. You're not doing anything productive in this extra time. You're just staring at your fucking screen, or you're shuffling around the office looking miserable. You're putting in time. And nothing productive's coming out of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important to remember that in the United States, we have no maximum length of the work week. 134 countries have laws setting a maximum length of the work week. We don't. 86% of men and 67% of women work more than 40 hours a week. In the U.S., there's not a federal law requiring paid sick days. In the U.S., we're the only industrialized country in the world that has no legally mandated annual leave. We're the only one that doesn't have paid parental leave. In every country except for Canada and Japan, workers get paid 20 paid vacation days. And in France and in Finland, they get 30. And in Austria, they have like a mixed system of like paid vacation days and paid holidays. So that amounts to like up to 40. Or maybe that's not Austria. Somebody else needs to go look that up. Don't take my word for it. Go look it up. In any case, the United States is really behind on these things. Like, we do have to think about this in a political context. The kind of movement that would be capable of actually winning a sabbatical would first have to win these things. But I think that these are really powerful things to fight for, because the fight for free time is enormously inspiring to people. I mean, I think it's what people want the most, honestly. And in fact, their desire for more pay is in many ways a proxy for the desire for more free time. Because you take a very low wage worker, the desire for more pay is often, in many cases, a desire to only work one job instead of two. If I could only get paid more at this one job, then I wouldn't have to work a second one. So really, it's kind of like a proxy for a desire for more free time. I think that the desire for more free time is like actually a fundamental political drive, a political motivating factor, and to build demands around them, I think, is really wise for the socialist movement. But of course, we're not going to start with the sabbatical. However, I think it's really important to throw it in the mix, so that when we're fighting for these smaller things, we can have a sort of horizon that's actually just like really, really inspiring, and that makes people realize that the more you win, the more you can then fight to win after that, and the world could really be a much better place, and life could really be much more worth living.
I really insist that everybody say what they would do with their first sabbatical.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that.
What set of things are on their minds, of things they might choose between? Because I know I gave like five things, but I want to hear everybody.
I do too.
Your things were so good, though. This is a kind of a funny story. So I've actually had, I guess, mini sabbaticals. When I was working in Vietnam, I was a teacher, and there was this kind of contract that you get as a teacher where you work for 11 months, and then you get like a bonus month's salary. So then you could continue working the 12th month, or you could just sort of fuck off and do as you would. If you worked, you got, you know, more money on top of the bonus, and if you didn't, you just took the money and ran. And I always took the money and ran. One year, I ended up going to the Philippines, to this little island called Coron, where there's a bunch of shipwrecks. A Japanese fleet got sunk there during World War II, which at the time was like the longest airstrike in the history of naval warfare. You have this very, just like boomer catnip, you know, like you'd have these guys come in and like bomber jackets and stuff. Just like, I remember when we, you know, they didn't sink any of these ships. But anyway, so this bay is full of sunken ships, and we would go down there every day. And for months, I spent my entire life either underwater carrying scuba equipment to the harbor or drinking rum in the equipment shed with the boat captains. And like, I've never felt more alive, like total freedom. Like I couldn't remember the last time as an adult where like I felt like I owned my life and I owned my time. But it turns out that it's fucking awesome. It's a great feeling.
Nathan, what would you do?
Well, I don't think I'm going to be drinking rum with sea captains, probably. But
they weren't real captains. I mean, these are mostly imposter captains, you know. They didn't have proper certifications.
But, you know, I've been thinking recently about how little I understand the natural world and how angry I am that I was never taught any plant identification in school. I can't tell different kinds of trees apart, and I don't really understand what the forms of life that are growing around me are. I just want to somehow get in touch with that. I am a person who has spent so little time in nature. I have been indoors probably 80% of my life. No more. I mean, I am always indoors. So I'd like to just be outdoors and I'd like to go see things and I'd like to, you know, go birding and sit an hour waiting to get a sighting of one particular kind of bird because I have time. You know, I'd like to see rivers and I'd like to see forests and I'd like to see just the incredible things that grow in our world that I never near because I'm just in front of a computer screen all day.
So half of the people on this call would do birding is what I'm getting.
Are there such things as flamingo ranches?
If there are, I will go find them on my sabbatical.
God, I would pay money to watch Nathan Flamingo Ranch, just like with a live webcam or something, like put it on a post out in the middle.
You mean like he's running the ranch?
Yeah,
or is he just like a farmhand on the ranch or like...
Am I living among them?
He's like a little shepherd.
Yes.
He's like going around with a little crook, just like herding the flamingos.
If herding flamingos is a job, I love it.
I love it.
That's good content, guys.
For my sabbatical, I would probably travel with some purpose. Like I would probably go to a place like Brazil for like 2 months, during which time I would try to... You know, you're getting paid, so you're getting paid your sort of normal amount, and you need to factor in the travel costs and lodging costs and so on. So you might not have, you know, the freedom to do literally everything that Brazil has to offer, but I would try to see a little bit of Brazil. But I would also spend my time in Brazil getting to know socialists in Brazil who are, you know, in various political formations and parties and tendencies and parties and getting a better sense of what they're doing. And then I would probably try to go to Greece and have a 2-month-long vacation in Greece punctuated by a couple weeks of getting to know some Greek leftists and learning what they're up to. And so I try to combine relaxing and traveling and just super vacationing with also trying to understand a little bit better the international political context that we're operating in, because it's very hard to tell from afar, but we do have this incredible network. As American socialists, there are many people in countries all over the world who would love to know what we're doing, would love to tell us what they're doing, and it would actually strengthen our movements to understand that. So that's my sort of dream sabbatical, is a year of travel and a leftist political exchange.
There'd probably be good parties, too. I imagine like the ouzo would be flowing. Greece is awesome. I highly recommend visiting.
Have you been everywhere?
I got family in Greece. There's a lot of us in Thessaloniki. It's hard to get rid of us. When you were talking about meeting Brazilian leftists or meeting Greek leftists, I think that's like super valuable. It's not just like meeting leftists, but just like people in general. One of the things that I think that's always been hard about building like international solidarity is that you just have no fucking clue what people X are or what they're like, you know? I remember for me going to the West Bank of occupied Palestine the first time, it was legitimately surprising to me how many people were Christian, which is not something that you hear, you know, a whole lot in the news, magazines, newspapers, anywhere. And I was like, oh, like it's really bizarre that all the people who I grew up with who were like, you know, hardcore, you know, kind of Christian Zionist types who were so, so preoccupied with, you know, any type of persecution of Christians around the world, rightfully so, persecution of anybody sucks and it shouldn't be done. Like, it's like they didn't know that Palestinians were Christians, or like they didn't know that they should care about these people's well-being. I do kind of wonder, like, if they had been able to go up to Palestine and see things with their own eyes, would that have changed their mind? Or is that, like, wishful thinking? I don't know. I like to think it would, though.
I don't want to overstate the extent to which travel turns you into a politically conscious person, because plenty of Americans travel to places and come home with an even more dehumanized concept of the people who are in the country that they visited than when they left, in a way, because of the structure of the tourism industry. At the same time, it's not like you can necessarily account for that by stopping Americans from traveling, right? So it's better to imagine that there are quite a few people who will have their outlook changed, and that that is better than no people having their outlook changed, and just hope for that in a way.
I know, like, one of the main points is that we don't want people to have to think about being productive all the time, but also there is a way in which capitalism is very inefficient in maximizing human potential. And there'll be this massive outpouring of, like, fulfilled human potential, where actually things would be produced that are not getting produced right now. Brianna has always talked to me about writing some kind of amusing satirical murder mystery, and I want to read it, but I'm never going to get to read it, because it's never going to get produced as long as Brianna is working constantly. I think it's so important to give people a sense of all the incredible things that are going to be made and come into the world from just letting people fulfill themselves.
You know, there was some recent study that came out that sort of showed quite starkly that the most important factor in whether or not you're going to be a professional artist is whether your parents are filthy rich. That's pretty much taken for granted at this point, which doesn't mean necessarily, in my opinion, that we should have, you know, contempt for artists. Artists make our world more beautiful. It's just that the art that is made is often very reflective of the types of perspectives that people who grow up with filthy rich parents tend to encounter, or the perspectives that they gravitate to when they're trying to like disidentify from their parents or whatever, which we could have a much greater creative diversity, and we could have a much greater diversity of artistic perspectives and cultural productions if people had more time, if people whose parents are not obscenely wealthy had more time to explore their own creative potential. So I think that's a really big part of why we should advocate for something like a sabbatical, is that I know it's a bit, you know, it's a little bit cliche. I'm not sure who said that quote about all the Einsteins and the Leonardo da Vincis who have died working in the sweatshops and so on. I can't remember where that quote comes from, but it's certainly true. But then at the same time, there shouldn't be an imperative to be creatively productive or to produce things that are enjoyable for other people, because fundamentally this is about people doing things that are enjoyable for themselves, because it's their lives and they ought to be able to live it because they're people and because people deserve that. This is an affirmation that people deserve to be able to live their own lives, because life is fleeting and people are mortal, and when it's gone, it's totally gone. You just die and then you don't get to do it anymore, and that's really unfair to not let people live their lives if they're going to die.
I think it would have a very good effect on like the arts generally, A, because like, as you say, you know, there are lots of people out there who are, you know, working in sweatshops, working like incredibly long hours, who are not getting to produce. But there is also this kind of obsession with like professionalization and like who's the best at doing particular kinds of art. And I think that's especially sad in terms of like music and dancing, which used to be, I think, very like kind of communal activities. And I think especially in the US, there isn't like, I don't think there's as much kind of like spontaneous art that gets done just because people enjoy it, not because they like are trying to be like professional artists. It'd be nice to encourage that a little bit more.
My happiness has been elevated substantially by the fact that I currently live in a city where there is a great deal of music in the streets, where you just hear people playing the trumpet on a street corner, or where you just hear a little band. As I bike to work, I'll pass like 5 different people playing music. And the reason that they can do it here is because we have a tourism economy, and they can actually make a living. You can actually make a living as a street musician here. But that's not true most places, and I think people are missing so much by not having streets filled with music.
Mm-hmm. And people are missing so much by not being able to play a musical instrument for their own enjoyment in their office hours. And this is something I wanted to also point out in the piece, is that you could learn some kind of skill or craft or art or a form of amusement even that requires some kind of learning process that could then provide you with greater enjoyment and make your life richer for the rest of your life if you had a sabbatical. The example that I used was completely random. It was kayaking. Let's say that you learn how to kayak during your sabbatical. Maybe it's one of many things that you do, but now you've acquired a skill that maybe you can do on weekends or on your normal vacations for all the time in between sabbaticals. And it's just going to make your life richer. It's going to make it more enjoyable.
You know what would be another, well, I think cool side effect of these sabbatical years was that like our physical environments might get more interesting to look at. Because right now they tend to be pretty boring, like unless you're lucky enough to live in the French Quarter, or there's pretty neighborhoods in every city. But like the vast majority of us live in these like really stark utilitarian boxes, essentially. And there's a story that I love. It's about a French guy. And forgive me, Vanessa, because I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of his name, but it's like Ferdinand Chaval, I think. And he was this 19th century postman who was like walking along his post route one day and decided to build a castle, you know, brick by brick, stone by stone. He ended up building this castle over, I don't know how many years. He had this line from his autobiography that I loved, and he said, "Constantly walking in the same surroundings, what could I do but dream?" He said, "To change my mind, I used to build a fairy-like palace beyond imagination with all that the genius of a humble man could conceive." Imagine if you walked down the street and there were like 10 people's personal palaces that they decided to build. You know, they have the time and the resources and the energy to do it. Like,
I think you're totally right. I think people's homes would become more interesting looking. People would put a lot of care into their homes during their sabbaticals. This is another point I wanted to make, is that sabbaticals would probably look very different based on where people are at in their lives. So like your first sabbatical presumably comes after 6 years after you've graduated either high school or college. So you're in your 20s, and maybe that's a time when you're feeling like you want to go explore the world. Then a lot of people after a certain point are going to have kids. And for them, they're not going to want to go travel with their children or in school. So they're not. That's not how they're going to spend their sabbatical unless they have an arrangement with their partner or family member. Or maybe they take a couple of months to travel, but they spend the rest of their sabbatical, you know, with their children. And first of all, it's going to be wonderful to see parents' relationships with their own children deepen when they're not spending all of their time either working or recovering from work while also trying to raise children. But also people are going to be, if they're homebound, they're going to do wonderful things with their homes. Of course, people have to, they're not going to have, you know, necessarily the resources. Again, you're getting a normal salary. You're not necessarily going to have the resources to really deck it out, but people would take the time, whether it's just simply to give the house a fresh coat of paint or to do something really creative to make their home feel like a place that is more reflective of their personality, of their aesthetics, and of their individuality. So I think you're right about it might have an effect on the physical environment.
This is a fun thing to start daydreaming about. Like, I would totally dig a moat around my place and have it just like, just have interesting things bobbing in it, like rafts or inflatable animals of different kinds. That would add, I hope, a little note of whimsy and delight to my neighbors' lives. Brianna, would you have like a bunch of like giant Venus flytraps or something to like eat the neighborhood kids if they got too close?
Maybe.
I just assumed that you hated me.
You were just describing, what book is it? Is it Great Expectations, where there's a character that builds like a moat around his house? He calls it like the castle, and he has like all these little devices that he's built in it. It just made me think of that. I don't have a home per se that I could like modify right now, but actually in the area where I live, I see lots of really cool gardens. They're the right balance of like, they're not like too manicured, but they also clearly are like well cared for. They're very beautiful. It would be cool to like, yeah, be able to put time into, you know, making a garden, putting gargoyles in the garden that you've made in your ceramics class and all that stuff.
I also have a home that I can't modify because I'm a renter, but there's a plot in the backyard that we could use for gardening, and we have tried on a couple of occasions, but you know, life always gets in the way, and so it hasn't really been super successful. But imagine if you had a whole year off, and let's say you're doing all kinds of other things, but you just make it a personal goal for the year to actually tend the garden, and it's completely possible for you to do that. I think you walk away from that with an understanding of how a garden in your physical space needs to be tended throughout all the seasons of the year, thereby making it easier when you're actually going back to working full time to know what to do to keep up a garden when you've got all of the other demands of life knocking on your door.
I was just going to ask Nathan what weird modifications he would make to his home or garden.
I don't know. I mean, just more beautiful, pointless things, more ornamentation, more elaborate
dioramas.
Yeah, giant dioramas involving human-sized.
Wait, would these be like animatronic?
Yeah, if I can make the move, I'll make the move. Yeah, I'll escalate the dioramas that I make for the current affairs table of contents to be gigantic. Beautiful, pointless things. That's what the world is getting fewer and fewer of, because the logic of efficiency just gets rid of ornament and gets rid of frivolity.
How would you adapt the sabbatical concept, perhaps, for people who are parents? I know a lot of parents who are incredibly stressed by being parents. And some of that, no doubt, is like the stress of having both a job and being a parent, which is also a job at the same time. But there is also kind of like, some parents might enjoy having a year to spend more time with their children, and some parents might feel like they needed to spend less time with their children during their sabbatical. I wonder if we would need to come up with some means of allowing parents to get away from their families a little bit during their sabbatical.
I mean, I think it would have to be a family choice for everybody. The way that I was thinking of it was like, if you wanted to get away from your kids for an extended period of time during your sabbatical, you would make an arrangement with your significant other and promise them that when it's their time to go on sabbatical, you'll fill in the gaps, right?
What if you don't have a significant other?
And if you don't, then I don't really know. Are you suggesting that we come up with some sort of like year-round boarding school for the children of sabbatical takers?
A child-sharing economy.
I was like, should we have like sabbatical co-ops where we like, you know, other people help take care of the kids for a while, or like sabbatical like sleepaway camps for like you know, a month or so, so you get like at least a month to yourself or something. I don't know. I'm not a parent myself, so I can't speak for others. But
I love thinking about this. One thing to go back, like to scale it back a little bit, that I do want to make a note of is that not only do I think that you'd have to fight for these smaller free time demands before you'd, in the process, you'd build up the muscle that you would need to actually win the sabbatical demand. So like just generally having mandatory paid vacation would probably come first before a sabbatical in the United States. But I also think that there are some things that you'd need to institute first in order to make the sabbatical truly about free time for people. So one of these is a job guarantee. That's actually really important because if you don't have full employment or near full employment, then people are going to be ineligible for the sabbatical simply because they weren't lucky enough to find full-time work, which is a problem. So that has to come first in the sort of order that we implement these reforms, right? But there are a couple of other things, one of which is you need paid parental leave. You know, that obviously I think we know that this is something that exists in other countries and it's entirely barbaric that we don't have it in the United States. So that would need to be one before the paid sabbatical, or else I'm concerned that there would be a sort of externality where people would try to line up having families with their sabbaticals, but you shouldn't be using the sabbatical to do things that you have a right to do anyway. You should be using the sabbatical specifically to do something that is completely your own. So the same is true for educational training. I think that you should be able to, at any point in your career, or if you wouldn't want to call it a career, your work life, you should be able to take time off and have it be paid for you to participate in employment training opportunities or educational opportunities that are enriching, not just for you personally, but for you as a worker, so that you can re-enter the workforce at a higher skill level and be eligible for a higher salary, for example. You know, this is, of course, in the context of we have not eliminated capitalism yet. This is sort of something that you do under social democracy. So you need to have like the paid educational leave, which I actually have in Austria. It has a really cool name. It's the Bildungskarenz. In Austria, you get a Bildungskarenz, which is a paid educational sabbatical for up to a year. And it's something that they've decided that they're willing to invest public resources into because it's an opportunity for workers to actually gain more skills and more training, which of course leads to, you know, like a more functioning society, right? So we'd have to institute that and paid parental leave first, because those are the things that we want people to take time off separate from their sabbatical to be able to do, so that when it comes time to do a sabbatical, you're not using it for that purpose. Now, it's a slight tangent from the sabbatical sleepaway camps idea, but I thought it was important to clarify that. And then, yes, I agree with you that we should start brainstorming ways to house the children of sabbatical takers who don't want to spend their time with their kids.
We won't tell them that's why. We'll tell them they've been picked for a special Hogwarts-like experience.
They're going to a nice farm family out in the country.
So I think we've all agreed that Megan's proposal is excellent and should be implemented immediately. We've reached the end of our hour, so I'd like to thank Megan Day for joining us here on Current Affairs. I wanted to talk to you for a long time, and I'm really glad we finally got to do it. To our listeners, why don't you call us at 504-867-8851 and tell us what you do on your sabbatical.
That's great. If you collect those, I really want to see. I think this should be an addendum to the articles. We should collect people's ideas for what they would do on their sabbatical and put it out.
Oh, just like a dedicated voicemail bag.
I was just thinking that's going to be so fun.
I encouraged this before I thought about the fact that Aisling has to now sift through like thousands of sabbatical voicemails.
You're welcome, Aisling.
I volunteer to listen to the drunk ones. The drunk ones are a lot of fun, guys. Please get drunk with your friends in parks and send us more voicemails because they're the best.
Yeah, you can also call our voicemail line about anything. You played on our voicemail. All right. Thanks very much. Good night, everybody.